What is he going to be talking about?
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Wednesday, June 10th. Hopefully, we're going to be joined by some of our other colleagues shortly. Today, I was hoping we're going to talk about what we've titled Pathways to Student Success. Hopefully, you all had a chance to read that article from the Atlantic Monthly, the Upwardly Mobile Barista, a sort of interesting title, but I found it to be really interesting and comprehensive kind of summation of some of the things that we've been struggling with and grappling with in the committee. One of the things that stood out in that to me was this discussion of how best to help students along in their academic journey. And Inside Track made an appearance there. What you may already know, I think I knew at one point and had sort of forgotten, was that Inside Track actually has a fairly significant presence in Oregon. So we're fortunate today to be joined by the founder and the president, Kai Dreckmiller. If you'd like to join us, please. I thought he could give us a little context about what they do. They've done some work in Oregon. On the phone is Dave King, provost at OSU, who's going to talk about sort of their experience. And then Karen and Jesse, just because we only have two seats there. Do you want to come up now, or do you want to wait until these guys are finished? Okay. So I think what we envision, if it's okay with you, Kai, is a fairly interactive kind of conversation, and hopefully you'd be all right with us interrupting you from time to time as you go through your slides, and then maybe we'll hear from Dave. I suspect, as you said, he knows some of what you're going to say, so we can let you say that. We'll ask questions, and then we can hear about the OSU experience. Does that sound okay to everybody?
Mm-hmm. Great. Perfect. Absolutely.
Please, Kai, if you can start by introducing yourself for our record, that'd be great, too.
Excellent. My name is Kai Dreckmeyer. I'm the president and one of the co-founders of Inside Track. We are an organization that exists to help colleges improve student retention and graduation rates, and we've done that successfully. That's been demonstrated in now more than 100 randomly controlled trials and formal evaluations. We do a number of other things for colleges, including helping them improve student readiness for the workforce. We call that career coaching. And at the end of the day, or at the end of our sort of 20 or 30 minutes here, I'll mention three areas I'm particularly interested in. One would be the concept of dual enrollment and pathways to employment from high school to college to workforce. We're doing some work in Idaho that ties to that. Also, just generally improving the performance and productivity of community colleges. They often really struggle, as we know. It's not easy. It's often a population that is underprepared to be in college. We're expecting a lot of them. The third one would be work related to programs like Dave King's at Oregon State University, where you're working to bring back adult learners to finish their degree or to get a master's degree, usually fully or mostly online. I think that's a big opportunity. There are a lot of adults out there with some credit but no degree and need to move forward. That's sort of the context. Again, I mentioned we've been at this for now about 15 years. It'll be 15 years in October. We have sort of by accident, when we started, we began to do studies to prove out to any of our university and college clients that our intervention works. I'll tell you more about what that is in a minute. And we've been able to show consistent results over time. Now have really more than 325 employees. The majority are coaches. At the core of our program, it is really executive coaching for students. You could call it counseling or advising, but it's probably more like having a really good manager in your life who is working with you to improve your effectiveness. I'll talk more about that program in a minute. We've now coached, either last week or this next week, we're going to cross the threshold of having coached 1 million students, which is exciting. The coaching at one point was done all one-on-one in person. Now it is done primarily by phone, supported by text and a digital web-based app that we've created, and also email, of course. So those are sort of the modes of it. And what I'm personally most excited about is that as we work with, you know, this is really a direct intervention for students. However, as we work with students at a college, we become very familiar with what's happening there and get a sense for the entire ecosystem supporting students and start to recognize opportunities to improve. And often, as we do that, we find things that are more scalable and cost-effective than the coaching itself. So that's the point here, is that coaching is known as this direct intervention with students to help them improve their behavior, improve their grit, their persistence. And as we do that, we start to understand better how the college is serving them, and we help make the college itself better. And I'll pick up on the slides. Understanding what the coaching is. Now that we've done so much of this, over on the left you can see these are what we call the focus areas. If we can get students to be happy and successful in these areas, they are much more likely to persist. As we work with students, we keep track of why they are struggling or why they're succeeding, and pretty much everything falls into these areas. One that we added only in the last 6 or 7 years is health and support, particularly with students at a community college who are often low-income first generation. All sorts of issues around poverty come with that as well. Finances, sort of obvious, paying for college. Effectiveness has to do with your ability to follow through and do what you set out to do. We work on that quite a bit. Another would be managing commitments, particularly for non-traditional or what we would call post-traditional students. They're working, they have kids, they have everything. Life is getting in the way and interfering with their education. We help deal with that. So the concept here is that we understand the challenges students are going to face. We help them address those proactively. So the key to our coaching is to help students clarify what their long-term goals are. Where are they going after college? And as we focus on career, it keeps them centered and motivated, committed. We help them connect with what it is that they need to get done. So there's a really practical element here. We help keep them organized and connected to resources. If you are a student who has not done particularly well in high school or in your formative years, any signal that you don't belong, that you can't do it, reinforces some beliefs you already have. We are working actively to help students change that mindset and keep them motivated. And another piece is to reaffirm the value of the institution, particularly if you are at an open access institution and it's not going well, it's easy to point the finger somewhere else, and we get students to take ownership for what they're doing.
Is that what the school community piece was?
Really, school community has to do with the student fitting in. We do a lot. The core of the coaching is, you could think, well, is this hand-holding? What happens when you leave? We're spending with each student 6 to 12 months to try to get that student to be as proactive and independent as possible. So part of it is getting them connected to other students, getting them connected to other professionals on campus. And that also has to do with the overall brand and experience that they're having broadly there at the college. Academics, obviously important. Career, we emphasize heavily. I should just note, we do a number of things for colleges and for students. On the front end, we help with the onboarding and the process of students coming in. We have been hired often by private colleges to help improve yield, and we've actually done that for some publics. If there are states where, in the Midwest, where enrollments are going down, they're really trying to make it attractive, and we're talking about coaching on the front end. Most of our work is in this green area with early-term students, but we work all the way through. And a big emphasis for us has been, over the last couple of years, is career coaching and job readiness and getting students to get their hands around that. We have early data suggesting that career coaching early on will help a student persist. I believe in the general value of education to create better citizens who are going to have a much more rich, fulfilling life. But what we've come to learn is that a focus on career outcomes is really what students want and what society needs right now. So this is very much very practical in that sense. Just a quick background on our work with Oregon State University. Dave can attest to this, but anytime we do come into a college, there is a question of, I should just note, wait, couldn't we do this ourselves? Won't you train us to do it? What's going on here? And so we have adjusted even over the last couple of years, moved in the direction of, we provide some of our work, then we help to train the college, we help to improve the college, and we get out of the way. My hope and belief is that we can now engage with a college for about 4 years, make real transformational change and get out. You know, that is our business model going forward, to sort of put ourselves out of business one college at a time. I don't want to say fortunately, but the reality is there are enough schools and they struggle enough that there's a lot of work to be done. So we worry less and less about that sort of sustainability. With Dave's campus, we worked with 667 students over a number of terms. Just to cut to the chase, overall, we improved retention by 4.5 percentage points, which may not sound like a lot, but their baseline, I didn't put all the data in here, is fairly high. This is a very good school. It is not open access, though broad access, but you not anyone can just show up and attend. So they're doing fairly well already. To move the needle that much is an accomplishment. We were hoping to get a minimum of 3 percentage points, got 4.5. Students found the program valuable. And this we find everywhere, but the more that the students engage with the program, the better that they do. And I should note, there is some causality there that we've shown, but also the more motivated a student is, the more they're going to use coaching. So a big piece of what we help colleges do is to realize they need to be very systematic in their outreach to students. Students who need help the most often are not embracing help-seeking behavior. Dave, just I'll ask, you can see me, I can't see you, any quick thing to add on this?
No, I think those are the numbers that we recognize too. But the return on investment was certainly there. The issue that that we face in a situation like this is that in order for us to be successful as part of the whole higher ed infrastructure to really reach the goals that we're talking about reaching, having a significant impact on the economic viability of individuals all across the state, we end up having to bring on partners like InsideTrack. And I think what the only issue I found at Oregon State was that that requires a certain amount of internal cultural change in order for us to do that. So we're kind of in the middle, as Kaya said, moving from direct intervention with a partnership to a training environment that I think will probably benefit all of us.
That's great. Thank you.
And we'll come back to you for more general comments if you're ready for that after Kai finishes.
Excellent.
No problem.
Great.
And I'm going to kind of zip through some of these, but we've amassed an incredible amount of data on why students are successful and not sometimes, and how we handle with that. And that data is useful, I think, not just from a institutional change or individual student success standpoint, but from a policy standpoint. We've got a ton of data, and we can share some of the studies we've done. Shared this earlier, not just phone, not just in person, but working with students through a variety of channels. And we are now looking at group coaching, and I would like others beyond us have experimented and had some success with peer coaching. When I think about what makes InsideTrack successful, it's not just the design of the coaching, but it's who the coaches are, how they're trained, and the way they're supervised and managed. And I think there is a world in which we can start to push this down, have students do some of this, provided that they are trained and managed and selected properly. So just a note on the coaches, when we do the coaching, which is now still the majority of the time, but we're moving towards, many of our employees are becoming trainers and consultants to help put this in the fabric of the university or college. But our coaches all have at least a bachelor's, roughly half have a master's. That's really not what we screen for. We're looking for, incredibly dynamic individuals. I would describe them as interpersonally gifted, and that is something we're helping colleges recognize. The people who should be right in front of students, they don't always have to be, the deep, heavy researcher. They've got to be someone who can motivate these students, that students can connect with.
Representative Wisner has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize to the chair and our presentation for people not being here. It's a very important subject. Go back to the slide about the actual. Can you comment on how on the traditional, it was school and community was 35%, and now after post-tradition, we're now 7%. We're spending a lot of time and effort to get counseling in high schools and some programs, so your slide indicates that's not a good helping success.
And I should clarify, because we use some language here that not everyone's familiar with. On the left, we're talking about traditional age students, 18 to 22.
Okay.
People always say non-traditional, meaning this big bucket of adults, anyone who is not Caucasian.
I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about your program that you went from what it was before to what it is now.
Yeah, and I should be more clear. And so this is really adults on the right for the most part, adults with a richer mix of low income and Latino, African-American students, that sort of thing. So the point here is that they struggle for different reasons.
So clarification.
Yeah, really, yeah.
So you're saying that these figures are what's happening today with our people in higher education.
That's right.
But you got different categories of people.
That's exactly right. Thank you. Just a couple notes from some of our other clients beyond Dave. In terms of the direction we're moving, And how am I doing on time? If I take another 5 minutes before, okay.
Yep.
Very proud of what we've done so far. And we have a successful and sustainable operation here. However, I would never tell anyone, go start a business in education, because it's very difficult. For a number of reasons, there is a suspicion of businesses coming in. There's another piece, which is, that's an important framing point, which is that when you're doing anything, three things that are in juxtaposition are quality, speed, and cost. You know, which one you want to emphasize, what kind of organization you want to be. Higher education, it seems, and education generally, is the emphasis affordable first, then let's do it fast. And, of course, it's got to work. But if you put that last, frankly, it never works. We're trying to flip this, and we have been seen as expensive. Where I think, to the best of my knowledge, the only organization that has been able to achieve these kind of results at scale with multiple institutions. We're now in the What Works Clearinghouse of the Department of Education as a high-impact, evidence-based practice. However, the marketplace, our buyers at colleges and universities say it's too expensive, even though it works. And we can't overcome that perception sometimes, so we're working actively to make our programs less expensive. We're also told, no matter what, even if it works, our employees want to do this. We've got advisors or people like them who would like to do this. So we've moved towards working on making this more cost-effective and really being willing to train and build capacity at colleges. So a process here of assessing what's happening at the college, helping them develop and build their own capabilities. And by Accelerate, we have convinced most of our partners as we go in, if you think that we're just going to train you over a week or a weekend and everything's going to be fine, it doesn't work that way. We need to come in and actually demonstrate how it works, why it works, and have them see our methodologies really for the way that we manage staff. And then beyond that, help them improve and make this part of their fabric. So that's what we're calling capacity building. We've been now doing this increasingly with community colleges. Anything we've done that's grant-funded or that is with open access institutions runs in this direction, because the tuition is often so low, it just doesn't support the, you know, we often would make an ROI argument saying every dollar invested in our program at your school will return three. Forget about the fact that it's better educational outcomes. That's good for the operation. Harder to make that case with a community college. Just a note from Larry Abel at Florida State. We did a lot of help with them on this years ago. I mentioned this a bit, but as we're working with students, we gain insights into what's happening at the college and are able to drive a systematic change there that is more sustainable. Our work definitely supports and enhances other student success initiatives from a variety of ways. More notes from students and university folks. Just a note on career coaching. I think this is, I should note, when we first started 15 years ago, the idea was to have a consumer business where students could sign up and get some coaching to increase the likelihood they would get a good job out of college. That worked, but it was a very hard business chasing after all of these students. We still look at that. Can we have a consumer presence where they would sign up online for our services? We are finding that it makes sense for colleges actually to pay for the career coaching. There's an emphasis. The the policy environment for years was so much about access. We're now tuning in to the fact that success is also important. Students need to complete. I mentioned the obsession with affordability and you know, always focusing on what's cheap. Finally, we're really thinking about, everyone's thinking about career outcomes and workforce development and coaching for students through their college experience on what are you going to do when you get out, what's going to take to be successful, what are employers looking for, completely gets a, really gets a student centered on what matters and embracing rigor and a seriousness as a student, which is a big problem in our society. I don't want to just seem to blame the students, but even at a selective four-year college, there are many students who are doing about half of what they need to get the full value of their education. When you get them focused on their future, that changes a lot. So career coaching, very powerful. Finally, I mentioned this earlier, but we've had a lot of success in randomly controlled trials, formal evaluations. About 4 or 5 years ago, a couple of Stanford professors did a meta-analysis of all of our data, spoke with our clients, looked at everything sort of top to bottom and determined, you know, this was a powerful, valuable program. We've gotten a lot of good coverage in various publications for being an innovative organization and workforce. I'm very proud of it. In many ways, if you were to visit our folks, I didn't mention this, we have a big office in Portland, Oregon. That's where really far more than half of our employees are now. It's just a better, for a number of reasons, great place to be. If you came into our offices, you would be, I think, so impressed with our people. They are both highly competent and they have the hearts, you know, they care about what they're doing. They want to make a difference in the world. It feels like a nonprofit, but we are working this in a way where we are not reliant on a constant stream of philanthropy. We are for-profit status and making it a sustainable business. And that's it.
Great.
So thanks all.
So lots of questions for me. I don't want to, I'll ask one to start and then maybe some others will. Can you take us through, I'm sure this is an unfair question in terms of asking for a typical experience, but imagine you can pick me. If I'm a student, what's my experience likely to be in terms of the interaction? We talked about text, talked about emails and that sort of stuff, but what's going to happen? What's life going to be like for me once I'm interacting with InsideTrack?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Makes it concrete. Ideally, at the beginning of the school year, maybe even before classes get started, a week or two, you would get an email or a letter from the dean or someone at the campus, maybe the provost, saying, hey, we have this program. You're going to be hearing from a coach. The coach might be described almost white-labeled as just part of the institution or could mention InsideTrack as sort of a professional services firm providing career coaching and support to college students. Increasingly, we talk about career from the beginning. Students get that and they want that. Even a student who is at risk often feels he or she's going to be okay, and they're in a little bit of denial. So we talk about, we work with the student sort of aspirationally on their goals and where they're going. Might have a first conversation ideally before school starts. It'll be roughly 30 minutes. Introduce the program and start to have the student articulate their plans, goals. Why are they in college? Why did they pick this college? And in the case where the student can't articulate that, we help them do that. There are a lot of good reasons. We're not sort of force-feeding them, but we're asking questions. The entire coaching experience is far more asking and helping a student reflect than it is telling and pushing. And that is critical. To have students take ownership for their life and their outcomes, we're pushing that, pushing them to come up with it on their own. We would also then probably have some practical things, information that we're bringing them, and having them start to imagine and foresee how things are going to go over the coming weeks and help them, and this is more needed for some students than others. Again, students are, you know, on a spectrum of readiness, but help them imagine who they want to be and redefine themselves in terms of identity, create a sense of belonging for them, that this is a great place for you for these reasons, and also normalize things. Most students, I should say, depending on the school, many or most, feel this is going to be hard, or at some point they're slipping, and they don't realize everyone is feeling that way. And so we're trying to reduce that sense of worry and panic that causes denial and spring them into action. And we also would ask you, hey, what's the best role for me as coach? And students need different things. Someone want a really, some want a supportive ear, others a drill sergeant, and it totally depends. So the coach is then, the student doesn't feel this, but the coach is constantly assessing how best to interact with the student and which focus areas that I shared to focus on. So early on, it is a lot about academics to make sure they hit the ground running and don't get behind. And also helping them think about their finances, not just financial aid and paying for college, but their budget in general. Just anytime I check into a hotel, if someone asks what I do, I explain and I say, you know, a lot of smart people go to college and don't finish for one reason or another. And almost every time the person at the desk says, wow, that's me. I'm thinking about going back though. And, you know, and they say I was working two jobs, trying to get through, didn't focus, so on and so forth. It is such a common story. So.
That's great. Thank you. Who's next? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several, so if I ask
you,
let me me to stop and I'll take another break.
We'll take turns.
What's the ratio of students to coach? What's the magic formula there? How many students could a coach work with effectively?
That is the key question. So when we first started, it was 75-1, basically, which is, you talk to anyone, that's outrageous. It's just too expensive. But it worked. We were able to get pretty tremendous outcomes. Partly, the bar was low 15 years ago. People were doing far too little to support students. Data was a mess. I don't think, generally, policymakers were aware of the problems, but it was not in the public, you know, sphere. So we have been on a march to expanding that ratio. It's more like 140 to 150 to 1 now.
Okay.
That means, as a coach, if every one of your students were showing up for a meeting, you could have a meeting with every student every 2 weeks, roughly, if you're working full-time. We have some programs where we're pushing beyond that, and we are in a process of taking everything that we know about coaching and digitizing that, creating an interactive process where you could possibly have this experience without a coach. I would not put forward for a minute that that's going to be effective at improving outcomes right now. I think over the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to get there. We can get our ratios up to more like 400 or 600. Mm. Right now, typical community college, they've got an advisor has sort of 500, 800, or 1,000 students. There is no real developmental advising happening. It's totally transactional and about registration. So with lower ratios, we have the time to have a relationship and to make real change. On your roster as a coach, you might find, you know, half of your time is spent on 30% of your students, but we're trying to be smart about spreading it because sometimes the students who, it's not just the most at-risk students who are going to benefit from the coaching. So we have to think of that.
So then what is the process for determining what students are at risk or which students will be paired with a coach? Is that the institution's discretion?
The matchmaking process?
Exactly, yeah.
That varies. I would say an ideal situation is we're making coaching available to everyone, and we focus it on the students who will benefit the most. And by that, I mean not just who are most at risk, but those who will benefit the most. And then we give access and opportunity to everyone. When I say benefit the most, I hate the idea of a bell curve, but let's just use it here, a bell curve of readiness and likelihood to succeed. On the far side, there are some students who are going to be okay no matter what you do. Even as the institution trips them up, they're going to finish. That's probably not the best place to put our focus. On the other end, there is a social justice reason for focusing on students who are really underprepared and at risk. However, we have done this enough that to see that there are some students who just aren't ready to be in college, and so often colleges dump resources there, and the sort of return on that investment is very poor. It appears that the group that responds most to coaching is that 60%, 70% in the middle, not the outliers, the 15% on the edges.
And that's measured by what? Describe that bell curve.
So a couple pieces. So first of all, when we come into an institution, if we do a randomly controlled trial, and we do fewer of these because we've done enough of them, we will make sure that we balance for all the factors of risk. You know, make two groups that are as similar as possible, flip a coin, and provide coaching to one of them. What's been great about that, to your question, Representative Reed. We've been able to look at across two large populations, say 2,000 students. As you separate those and you look at the subgroups within them, you start to see where you're having an impact. And that's how we know we have more of an impact in the middle. And again, I would love to give this to every student. I think even a student who's going to graduate without our help is going to come out. You know, we raise all boats. They're going to come out better prepared for, even better prepared for life and more successful. But we're in a world of constrained resources. So as we talk to colleges, we're often telling them, let's focus on where we're going to get the greatest impact. We'll focus the coaching there. And as we do that, by working with students, we're going to surface various opportunities for the college to improve that are going to help everybody. And when we do process improvement for a college, those things disproportionately help low-income, high-risk students, really. They're often tripped up by the some of the bureaucratic pieces they've got to go through.
We're probably all imagining those in our mind. Those were our own experiences. Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
And then I would also talk about the differentiation between your coaching at a two-year versus a four-year institution. If you have different student groups and so forth, different needs, I would say, as well. Anything you can share about how that plays out differently in terms of the coaching strategy and engagement practices?
Yeah, definitely. So at a two-year, there are more what we call post-traditional students. Mm-hmm. They're coming back. Some are older. Some are traditional. But most are lower income, not all. And so there's a mix. So some of the coaching at a two-year institution, it's got a little bit more of an element of social work and helping them manage things kind of outside of life. At a traditional four-year, especially if it's a little more selective, we are just dealing with issues of maturation of 18 to 22, kind of becoming an adult and being responsible, thinking about the future. So it does vary. Those are, putting people into two groups that are not homogenous at all, but that's a generalization.
And then you mentioned, I think at OSU, you increased the completion rate by about 4% or so. What kind of outcomes do you have at the community college level? I guess I'm guessing they would be more significant, right?
Well, at OSU was just a year and a half ago, so mm-hmm. that was the initial kind of enrollment and retention uplift. We don't know about completion rates yet, but based on that, we would expect to see a 3 to 5 percentage point improvement in completion rate. At a community college, the bar is often very low, and from a policy standpoint, I think we should be looking right now, the IPED system of the federal government for looking at student success is so focused on first-time, full-time freshmen. Community colleges don't get as much credit for the fact that they're taking some students who are older, who have some credit, and they're getting them through, and maybe they're completing there after a year, but they're not counted towards their graduate total. So that whole system is a bit of a mess. But I would say, generally, community colleges, we should look at the rate at which they're helping students finish, transfer, and also just complete and amass credits. Still, the bar is low. We can make a bigger impact there, for sure. I would say it's reasonable that if we were to work, you know, our plan, something I'm working on, we're calling Completion Catalyst. We've got some funding from Lumina Foundation that's focused on higher ed. We're putting together a program that will create, over 4 years, ideally, a 5 percentage point or more improvement in completion rate and also driving up transfer rate or keeping it constant. That's important because if you're looking at a roughly 25% baseline,
right,
5 points over that, bring it to 30 is a 20% improvement.
It's the national average.
Yeah. And so we're really excited about that. I think there's a big opportunity there.
The other thing you mentioned that I thought was intriguing was the idea of peer coaches. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you thought about trying to develop culturally relevant peer coaches, i.e. students who have completed but, they're members of a certain type of demographic or group or whatever, but who could provide that sort of, be paired up with students who meet that same profile. I think that would be a powerful way to engage with students.
Absolutely, and very briefly I'll share. In the past, I've been skeptical, when I say 5 years ago, of peer coaching, because doing anything, people forget, it's the management, it's the whole mechanism of how you do these things to have real fidelity around it. People have to be supervised and supported. Otherwise, you're ignoring them, and they don't do a very good job. That's often with any kind of college employment, the experience sometimes. To your point, Representative Johnson, Georgia State had tremendous success. They had a lot of Pell-eligible, low-income students, African-American, okay. who were working, you know, on campus in, I forget what you call that, work-study jobs.
Sure. Yeah.
They found out, hey, some of these students are doing really well in these courses
yeah.
that everyone else is failing. Let's make them tutors. They brought them over to support other students. They've now got their African-American male graduation rate up above the overall. You're not seeing that most places. So they've done something pretty special. I think there's real promise with good peer coaching, peer advising, peer tutoring.
Bridget Burns talked about that from the University
right.
Innovation Alliance when she was here earlier in the session. So.
And she introduced me yeah. to Tim Rennick at Georgia State. That's how I know it also
okay.
from
okay.
Bridget Burns. Yeah.
All right.
She's
good.
Great.
Yeah. yeah.
Good.
One final one,
yeah,
if
please.
I might, Mr. Chair. Have you considered engaging with a state-level association to provide training, i.e., let's just say the Oregon Community College Association as a whole, rather than working with the individual colleges, if there was a desire and the ability to actually engage at that level so that the training could be disseminated to all 17, but go formulate, establish it at this level, and then it gets disseminated to the different colleges in a way that, you know, meets your criteria and so forth, but rather than going out to each college campus and trying to interact with the culture there.
Yeah, it's a really good idea. I should note two things. We are working with the national organization, SHEO, you know, State Higher Education Executive Officers. We haven't done what you've mentioned. It is only in the last couple of years we're really making a push at community colleges, because our experience was this is sort of impossible. They don't have any money. No one's going to support it. They're already so we're finally, we're like, you know, you can't think that way. So we're making a real push to be part of the solution here. The challenge that I just want to, that still exists, is that everyone is looking for something that is really inexpensive mm-hmm. and a weekend workshop. And it just doesn't drive real change. So I think if I love that idea. I still think it makes sense mm-hmm. to look systematically at the college, do some strategic planning, have an outsider who actually is going to provide services, see what's happening now, and then come in and do this in a sustained way. There's a risk of the challenge with what you just mentioned is that, like, yes, we're providing workshops. We've got this new thing. We find a price point everybody likes. And suddenly it looks like we're ineffective because we've gone the road that everyone else is going down of how can you do these little drips? You know, there's a little bit of money here. Let's see what we can do with that. And my experience is that it's you need to take a different perspective.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Rudin.
I apologize if you've already covered this. I had to step out. But I'm really glad to hear your presentation, because one of the things I'm very surprised about being a first-time guy on this panel is that the need for guidance and how huge that is to driving student success. So really glad to hear this. But really simple questions. How are you compensated, and is this like are you contracting out or replacing college staff? What's the business model, I guess, is what I'm...
Yeah, it's entirely fee for service. So come up with a contractual arrangement based on the amount of work we're going to do. Often there's a per student price in there. The question of is this outsourcing, there has been a problem. We've been perceived that way. I think in any college we've worked with, staff has never been reduced or laid off, frankly. We've always focused on colleges where, as we make a difference, just the tuition revenue is going to go up and create a better kind of economic situation for everyone. One thing I mentioned earlier that you may or may have heard is that because of this, we're moving much more towards training. There is such a fear mm-hmm. of the idea that we'll be outsourcing or replacing folks. It's kind of a non-starter. The idea of, oh, could you contract with us? We're going to help raise outcomes. Yeah, let me talk with others. They said no. You know, Dave also had this. Dave's a big advocate for us, Dave King
yeah.
from OSU. Great staff, but still there's a sense of, like, what does this mean for us? Is there a risk here? And so we realized we have got to find a way to make focus on capacity building and training, and that's where we've gone. So that's still, it's a growing piece of our business, but 15% to 20%. I think over the next 5 years, it's going to be more like 60% to 80% of what we do.
That really makes sense, because as I understand it, we're so far behind on our ability to offer the counseling that students need that anything you did would have to be an augment that. So, so I have to ask, this might be for personal reasons, but when do students decide what they want to do when they grow up? You mentioned that as one of the first bullet points of clarify their future. And I worked on that until I was about 70 or, no, not 70 yet, but many years.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It varies broadly. And so as we're working with students, we're coaching. We're not advising and suggesting they go in certain areas. However, as they have an eye towards their future, we start to ask, functionally, what are some things that you might enjoy and like? And functionally, I mean, are you more interested in finance or marketing or people or these different areas? And then your values, what do you care about? Is it more about making a difference in the world, sustainability? Is it money? You know, is it the arts? Start to ask these questions, and you don't even have to, at some point a student does need to choose a major, right, and stay focused, but even once you've got a major, you can change later on. It's good to start to imagine some of these endpoints and have that clarity. So I guess I'm sort of saying two things. We want students to commit to something, but to realize they're not, you know, planning their life story entirely, and that they want to build competencies and skills and start to know who they are. You know, the industries they're interested in, the kind of values they have, and the competencies and functions.
So not to put words into your mouth, but sort of what questions do I ask? How do I approach this decision that we all have to make?
And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And there's a big emphasis on that. Going forward, many people will have, you know, multiple careers. And I do think, and I'll just mention, this idea that college, high school to college, has got to be a little bit more about preparing students for jobs. There is a downside that if it's too vocational, we are kind of painting a student into a narrow space without a big future. And sometimes a liberal arts education, if you look at who's leading, you know, there are often folks who study the liberal arts, and we need to prepare folks for 30 years out and to create some aspirations that they could do many things. So my ideal world is there's a career path for everybody that starts off where you're doing some basic stuff, but you've got real possibility down the road.
Former University of Washington President Mark Emmert observed that the most common major amongst CEOs is history. Interesting. Representative Wisnik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. Three questions, quick. Would you define your mission as graduation or success in life, like follow up to Representative Reardon's comments, how would you define your mission of your organization?
It really is about unlocking the potential in individuals and organizations, so it's beyond graduation. And it's really interesting. We're finding getting students to shoot beyond graduation and think about life after college is a better way to get them through college than just think about finishing. Mm-hmm. Now, a core piece of this is, you know, practically, it is about graduation and completion rates, but our mission really is unlocking the potential in, you know, 100 million people over the next 10 to 20 years.
Follow up.
Go ahead, please.
How many other companies are in doing this business, or your competition for you?
You know, not enough. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it sounds as though there's an exact kind of replica startup coming together, that somebody forwarded me something about that the other day. There are a number of technology providers who make similar claims and try and do this in, you know, as affordably as possible. There are a lot of consulting firms who help colleges in different ways. No one has, you know, put together this sort of a coaching program with these sort of results to this point.
And I think it was a good question from Representative Reardon, but, you know, that it shouldn't be our concern, are you replacing me? It should be, what are we providing our graduation and our universities again? It does enter into the conversation, are you trying to replace me or lose my job? But, and the final thing is, I'm one of the, I guess, probably the oldest one on here, and first-generation family member to go to college. But I would expect, hopefully now, that more students come from families with at least some college experience, and that would seem to be more helpful than when I started and had no background as far as support of what I'm doing. And I came in the system when State University their mission was to eliminate at least one-third of the freshman class because they didn't have facilities for the rest of the curriculum. So comment on that.
Yeah, it's a good point. And so we are moving in that direction. We're expecting more and more people to go to college. So there's still a large number of students coming in who are first generation. And I think that we are moving towards a moment of how do we facilitate success for students. However, there is a role for faculty and others to hold the bar high and have it be meaningful. You know, if you make it to 40-40-20, I believe I'm saying that right.
You are.
But someone from the outside could say, yeah, you did it by making it easier. That would not be a good thing. And so I think having it be meaningful, rigorous, and improving outcomes is where we're headed.
That's great. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Mr. Trechtmeyer. A couple of questions. One, can you tell us what your staff are like, the training? Are they psychologists, social workers, vocational counselors? What training do they have?
It's a real mix. We're hiring more for temperament and sort of basic ability more than background. But I think I shared a slide earlier. All have a bachelor's, roughly half have a master's degree. Many have worked at universities or in K-12 or doing social work, something in kind of support type services. However, we have folks who are retired business people and a real variety. People who are kind of finding it, need to find real meaning and do important work that they felt they couldn't do before.
Yeah. Follow up. Yeah. Obviously, your company's found a provide the service for which there apparently is a need out there. And I'm just curious, one, about the need. It seems to me that one of the tasks of your company is to help overcome some negative messaging that a lot of low-income minority kids get through the K-12 system. And again, we've heard a lot of testimony in this committee about how important it is to instill hope and make sure that these young people have the hope of succeeding, and that seems to me a major hurdle. And again, I think that obviously coaching is something that is meant to sort of help with that. I guess, though, I'm also curious that when you say you provide a fee for service, I'm curious, is there a subsidy from the colleges to for this cost, or are you basically providing a cost to these low-income students? I mean, it seems like the burden then of this kind of advising is placed on these low-income students when it really should be a function of the university or the college.
Yeah, good point. To clarify, I think 100% of the time right now where we're providing services at a college, it's paid for by the college. We have had some schools look at, could we have a student fee for this? Never have they put that together. So it is a good point. You could argue for some students going and trying to get a degree that they don't get and going into debt, they're worse off. So I agree that could be a real problem. So yeah, no cost to the student at this point.
Okay. I think we've exhausted our questions for you for the moment, but please stick around. We may have more. Dave, if we haven't bored you on the phone, we'd love to hear your perspective from OSU. And hopefully we've asked enough of our questions that we may be less likely to interrupt you.
Yeah. Oh, no problem. I appreciate the opportunity. I am Dave King, the Associate Provost for Outreach and Engagement at Oregon State. I am responsible for the extended campus summer session for professional continuing education and extension course development. So the kinds of things that we're talking about here today. What I thought I would do first, and I can get to some of the specific questions and comments that have come up about our relationship with Inside Track and that, but just to kind of set the stage a little bit for why this is so critical, both to us as a university as well as the education enterprise across the state as a whole. There are 940,000 people in Oregon with some college and no bachelor's degree. And those folks are finding themselves now, in their professional lives, working someplace, looking around and seeing that the folks with bachelor's degrees are being promoted faster, quicker, into more improved salaries and things like that. Those folks are coming to us at Oregon State right now. We have 7,000 of that 940,000 who are, basically working adults who are pursuing a bachelor's degree in one of the 41 different degree programs that we offer online. And their, their goal is real clear to them. I mean, this is, if you look at what, and Kai said this, but at our universities these days, between 85 and 70% of our students across the country as a whole, depending on the institution and where you are what we would call post-traditional. These students are working full or part-time, they're caring for a dependent, they're in some way involved in a great deal of other things in their lives other than going to school. They're dramatically different from that 18-year-old who came straight out of high school and, and is pursuing, with nonstop pursuing a bachelor's degree. So in this environment, we look to all sources of students and potential opportunities to bring more students and more learners to the potential success and get a bachelor's degree and complete. I was just reading a book by Goldie Blumenstein. She is she's a writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And she just released a new book. I highly recommend it. Those of you on the committee, I think, would find it very interesting. The title is American Higher Education in Crisis. And one of the things that she says in the book is that about 85% of the students that enter community college assume that they are going to continue on to a four-year university, but only 17% actually do. And with those of us at the university level looking to, participate and take a look at how to build the 40-40-20, and we don't have enough 18-year-olds coming in the pipeline to actually do that. We have to reach into that group of 940,000, the predominantly adult learners, and bring them more effectively to education. So what Kai's talking about here is, one factor in a very broad and spectrum of factors that we need to deal with. What I found, at OSU and with our peer institutions around the country, we're all kind of coming to the same conclusion that in order to be successful in this, we need to partner with the inside tracks of the world, with other third-party providers who provide a very specific capability, a very specific service that isn't always something that we can just easily duplicate, quickly duplicate at a place like Oregon State. One of the questions that was raised, focused on did the service that we partnered with InsideTrack actually replace people at Oregon State? And that wasn't the case at all. It was an added service that helped improve our ability to reach the retention goals that we were looking at. At one point early on in the conversation, I had one of our folks in our extended campus group run an analysis of what it would take for us to duplicate the kind of service that we were planning on acquiring, partnering with InsideTrack to offer. And he said, well, it's easy. We could hire 10 more people, which is, just completely not something that's in the realm of reality right now. I mean, even where would I put them even if I could hire them? But the goal, on the other hand, was to reach out to this this 30-year-old adult learner who's just decided to come back to Oregon State and be a student again, who's looked around his or her business or home life or community life and thought, you know, if I'm going to go anywhere, I better get that degree. And they know exactly why they're going to do it. But that first term, that second term back, they are most at risk. And I think we all can relate to that. You can imagine what it takes a student to actually kind of step up and say, I've made the decision. I figured out where to find the money. I am going to do this. And then they start and they go, wow, it's really hard. And they're at risk that first term and second term. So what we did with Inside Track was have them come in and provide that coaching service. And it didn't replace academic advisors. It didn't replace our success advisors. It didn't replace any of our financial aid advisors. What it did was create an intersection, a personal intersection with those very at-risk students back to the kind of labyrinthian environment that is the university. And so, the typical kind of conversation might be to call somebody or text somebody and say, you had that chemistry midterm last week. How'd it go? Did you get that financial aid information in like you said you were going to? Or did you actually get your connected to your academic advisor? Well, hey, let's call him or her right now and see if we can't connect you, real time back to get that done. It's just it's a coaching. It truly is coaching at that level. And we did, as Kai said, see a significant and adequate increase in retention in the initial aspect of it. Does that persist through to actual graduation? We're still running those numbers now, and we'll see. But it's the only way that we are going to be globally successful is to look to all the partners that we can find and work closely and collaboratively across those lines. So I'd be glad to take questions. There are other things we can talk about, but
that's great.
That's pretty much where we are.
That's great. Thank you. And I should have explained to the rest of the committee, Dave's at a conference, a higher ed conference, or he would have been here in person. But we're really grateful for your willingness to get on the phone amidst your other responsibilities. Any questions for Dave? No, I think you've done a good job explaining your experience. So we're grateful for that. You're obviously welcome to stick on the phone and be part of the rest of our conversation. If you've got other things you need to do, we're happy to let you excuse yourself too.
I appreciate that. I should get back to the conference.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to connecting again.
All right. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye. So that takes us to Western Oregon. Would you two like to join us and give us your perspective as well, please?
Should I stay here?
If you're willing to stay, that'd
all
be
right.
Great.
Do you need the slides or anything? I actually will.
Okay, I'll let you sit
Trade.
Here.
What about musical chairs?
All right, thanks.
Good morning, Chairman.
If you could turn the mic, it doesn't have to be right in front of you. It will distort if it's too close, but just
okay.
In the general direction is great.
Better?
That's
okay.
Perfect.
Good
Thanks.
Morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chairs Gallegos and Wisnant, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Sullivan Vance, and I'm the Director of the Academic Advising and Learning Center at Western Oregon University. Western has approximately 6,200 students. And about every year our entering freshman class, 50 to 52% of them are first generation students. So we are definitely an institution that is focused on access for students. But it's not just access, we want students to persist towards degree completion. Our role in advising is really helping students to identify their educational plan, but in relation to their life and career goals. So who are you? What are you trying to do? What do you want to do with your life? And to try and help students get there. The university focuses on retention, which are really those things that the institution does that can help the student to persist towards graduation, and also on persistence, helping students access resources and supports that will help them transition into, through, and out of the university. In 2012, we developed the Wolf Connection System, also known as WCS. It's an online early online early alert referral system for faculty and staff, whereby faculty and staff, if they think that a student is struggling or having difficulty, they can contact the student success specialist and do what's called a request for intervention. So that individual can then contact the student when the problem is happening and provide them resources and support. It's one of the goals of what's known as intrusive advising, which is a term used in the field, but is simply proactive advising, reaching out in real time when something is happening. Students are contacted by the student success specialist, and those interventions may be a one-time intervention, or it may be multiple interventions that take time over several terms to help that student get on track academically. We use those interventions along with educational workshops around academic warning and probation to help students also continue to be successful. I'd like to go ahead and turn this over now to Jesse Poole, who's our student success specialist at Western. Jesse's been with us since 2012. I'd also like to note that just this past month, Jesse was awarded the Outstanding New Advisor Primary Award from NACADA, which is the Global Community for Academic Advising. There are 12,000 members around the globe for that. Since 2008, Western has had 18 advising awards for our faculty and staff, which is twice that of all Oregon institutions combined. So I'm going to turn it over to Jesse so he can talk with you about Wolf Connection Systems, and then we'll take questions.
Great. Congratulations on the award. Of course, the downside is that the expectations from this panel just went up a lot. So,
exactly.
Well, good morning, everyone. Yeah. The Wolf Connection System started as a simple one-to-one referral program. And
Ms. Poole, if you could introduce yourself. I know we've referred to you by name,
absolutely.
But we need you to say it too.
Sure. My name is Jesse Poole, and thanks. I'm the Student Success Specialist at Western Oregon University. So I have a couple of slides that are really screenshots, and they're not intended to parallel what I'm talking about right now. So they're actually going to come after I'm done speaking. But the WCS program was initially designed to be a one-to-one referral system where a faculty or staff member is able to refer a student to me that they've seen as being at risk. Oftentimes, our faculty members see a student in the back of their classroom. Their head is down. Their face is flushed. They could tell that they might have been crying. But the faculty member doesn't necessarily feel comfortable approaching that student or contacting that student. So we've kind of created a system where they're able to say, hey, I want to help, but I don't have the resources or the tools to do so. And they're able to refer that student to me electronically. Since the original implementation in 2012, more than a dozen new features have been added to the program and is now being utilized in 6 different support offices across campus. There's 4 main pillars to WCS: the early alert, advising management, tutoring management, and communications. So the program has evolved from a simple one-to-one referral program to something that is really being utilized across our campus in all of our professional advising centers, our student enrichment program, which is also referred to as a TRIO program, and our multicultural student services program. They use WCS to manage all of their student contacts and their advising notes, how many students they see, how long they see them for, and what kind of conversations they have with them. Each area has a list of features that operates very intuitively. Some of these features include electronic attendance tracking with automated email notifications to the student, the student's advisor, and if they're a student athlete, their coach gets a notification as well if they're not showing up to class. WCS also allows for electronic progress reporting campaigns. These campaigns are used by our athletic department to track performance for our student athletes. Prior to this feature, our student athletes had to take a paper slip to their faculty members midway through the term and say, "What's my grade?" Often this happened directly after class or before class. Being an adjunct instructor myself, I had it occur a couple of times. And faculty often don't have your grade right on hand right there. So often they would have to come back, they'd have to go to their office hours, and Sometimes it would slip through the cracks, and the feedback wasn't getting to the appropriate people. Now, the way that the campaign works is the faculty will get an email with a list of students, student-athletes that are in their classes. Say these students are student-athletes. We basically want to know how they're doing. The faculty don't even have to sign into the program. It's set up through what's called single sign-on. So when the faculty member clicks on the link in the email, it auto-authenticates who they are, and the faculty member simply provides the feedback and hits submit. So we're also trying to make it as intuitive as possible so the faculty aren't having to do a significant amount of extra work to provide meaningful feedback. WCS also allows for... let's see, where are we? Oh, sorry about that. I lost my place. When an athlete is marked at risk, an email is generated to the student as well as to their advisor. And again, if they're a student athlete, it's going to go to their coach. And then what happens is an automatic case is opened. That's what we call a case. And I will attempt to contact that student. First, we start with an email. And then if I don't hear from them, usually in about a 48-hour period, I pick up the phone and give them a call. I'll check my schedule to see if they've called the front desk to schedule an appointment with me. But then I start really reaching out to them in that way. In addition to progress reports, all faculty and staff at Western have the ability to submit an electronic referral to the student success specialist regarding students that are at risk. So anybody at the university has access to WCS as far as referring a student. And that's really key, because often we will have program assistants that are in the business department that met with a student, or a student came in to talk to their advisor and they were crying or they were upset. They realized that something on their degree evaluation wasn't right, and there wasn't anybody to talk to them right away, or they just made a side comment about how they're struggling financially. I had two students last year separately in two different cases where their houses burnt down. And they didn't say anything to anyone. It wasn't until their faculty members sent a referral to me that said, something's not right. You know, these students, you know, their grades are plummeting. They're upset. You know, will you reach out to them? And that's exactly what we did. I picked up the phone, gave them a call. They came in and met with me, and they said, yeah, my house burned down. And I hadn't said anything to anybody because... you know, by default, they didn't think anybody cared. Like, of course we care. So then I was able to connect them to other resources on campus. I was able to help them a little bit financially. And then also I was able to advocate for them to their faculty and say, hey, this is what's happened, you know, consistent with university policy. Please consider giving this student an extension on, you know, some homework and some other things. I was able to connect them with the library, get them, you know, some of their books that were on loans. They were able to utilize them that way without having to go out and purchase books.
We'll jump in just a little bit. I'm thinking about the clock here a little bit too, in terms of making sure that we have an opportunity for questions for you. So if you're nearing the end, that might be good.
I can near the end.
Very well done. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I would just like to say,
yeah.
You know, what we've seen so far, we're doing, you know, assessment ongoing through it, but we've seen a drop in numbers of students on suspension, students who progress to academic suspension. Those numbers have dropped 30%. The students on probation, those numbers have dropped 28%. And the students on warning, I think it was 32%. So I think having someone on campus who is familiar with all the offices, I would completely agree with what Dave said about institutions oftentimes develop these very labyrinthian processes. And we have students who come on campus and we somehow expect you've been admitted, now you should just be able to navigate it. And the role that Jesse provides is he's not only a navigator, a mentor, he's also a coach, but he's one of those people who's there who can actually say, I know exactly who you need to speak to. He can pick up the phone, make sure that person is there, walk that student over there if the student is nervous about talking to somebody else. So I think that's the advantage for us on our campus of having someone in that position. And to date, we've kind of outgrown Jesse. I have in for another Jesse, and I'm hoping that in this new next year we'll be able to get another Jesse, because it's essential. We do want students to graduate. We want them to persist towards graduation, and we need to support them in that role.
Great. Thank you.
And if maybe Jesse could just show you a couple of your slides.
Sure.
That would be.
Yep.
I believe one of the representatives had a question.
Sorry.
Do you want to ask a question now? Or do you want to wait for slides?
Real quick. I think you said that, or I heard anyway, that anyone had access to the referral system?
Absolutely, sir.
Would that mean that if I'm a student and I saw that another student was having an issue of some kind or had said something that was very concerning, could I refer that to you?
The program has the access to provide students with that option. We have a separate system at our university for student-to-student referral contacts. The WCS program is specifically for faculty and staff to refer a student to my office. But we do have a system in place for a student that has recognized that another student is struggling.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome.
So if you want to run through slides quickly, I want to make sure we have time for questions, and unfortunately there are other obligations that are starting to pull on all of us.
Absolutely. So I know I can explain this to you all, but it's always nice to have a little bit of a visual. Yep. So these are a couple of screenshots that I've taken, and this is in a training site, so there's not much to see here, but this is the advising homepage that our advisors would see when they log into WCS. So in the top right there, you see the blue issue an alert button. Everybody has access to do that. But if they're a faculty advisor, right here where it says you don't have any assigned students, there'd be a list of students if you were assigned a list of advisees. It also tracks your upcoming appointments. It syncs with our Google Calendar. So anything that we enter into there will also come into our Android or iPhone devices. It also sends out automatic email notifications and reminders to students for their upcoming appointments, and a list of students that are in our queue. This is fantastic for times during the term where we have walk-in week and we have a large number of students that are waiting to meet with an advisor. This tracks who's waiting for who, or if they're looking for just general advising, and how long they've been waiting. And then to the left here, this is a side pop-out menu. And it kind of gives you just a little bit of an idea of all the different things that WCS provides. WCS isn't built internally. It's actually powered by a company called Grades First. So it's not something that Western has created, but it's something that we've been able to rebrand. And depending on what type of roles you have, it will change the interface. So here we're at advising home, but I also have a professor home where if I'm teaching a class and I do teach, I can click on that button and it will switch my interface to a professor screen. And there's a shot of that as well. So it looks something like this. It will list all of the classes that I'm teaching. This was actually from our production site, so the students' information to comply with FERPA obviously is blacked out, but you'd have a list of your students that are in those courses. And then as you can see to the right there, it says progress reports. You can click on that at any point in time in the term, and you can submit progress reports, say after a midterm, and identify students that have failed your midterm, and that will kind of start that communication process. It also tracks attendance, which was something I mentioned before as well, and it provides patterns. So students that were absent, students that were present. If you're marked absent, you get an email as well. So if a mistake was made, obviously the student can say, hey, I was here. But it also helps the students recognize that their faculty members are actually keeping track. And this was really interesting. The faculty that have been using this have noticed significant decline in the amount of students that are skipping class. It's amazing how much an email can do.
You get what you measure.
Right.
Good. Very good. Well, thanks for making these the presentation. Thanks for getting us the sense of what's happening at Western. Are there any quick questions for Western Reading?
I have a I don't know, more of an observation, or I'm just curious about the impact of these efforts with regard to traditional faculty roles of research, teaching, and service usually including advising. And so, again, just the impact of this effort with regard to that sort of traditional academic.
Well, we do have we have what's called a shared model at Western. So once a student has determined their they've selected their major, they're assigned a faculty advisor in that department. But the Academic Advising and Learning Center also works with students who are pre-nursing, pre-CJ, students in academic difficulty, or any student who has questions. But I think, you know, one of the things is, you know, quite honestly, faculty are hired because they are experts in their field. And oftentimes, there can be faculty members who are not comfortable dealing with some of the personal issues or the societal issues that students face. And what we found is that, you know, faculty that are comfortable with that, that's not an issue. The faculty who are not comfortable with that or going into those sorts of discussions with students are very happy to have someone like Jesse on campus because, one, they want the student to get help. They just may not know how to give it themselves or don't have the disposition to have those conversations, knowing that they have that resource. In fact, one of the departments, I won't name it, refers to Jesse as a verb, that they have Jesse'd a student because they know that Jesse is going to help the student and be there for the student.
That's when you know you've succeeded, when your name becomes a verb.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Really good. So one last question I forgot to ask you, Kai. Why Portland as a center for your employment base?
You know, as we looked at cities, San Francisco is a great place, but it is prohibitively expensive operate a business. And so we started looking at other areas that weren't too far away. We wanted to stay on the West Coast with a high rate of adults with a bachelor's degree, and actually at that time also very high unemployment. So, man, talk about a lot of baristas out there who were overeducated, underemployed. And the cost of living was such that we had a number of people wanting to move up and could have sort of a living, I don't want to say living wage, but a situation where they could do this work and live comfortably.
Good. And are we doing what we need to help you stay here and
yes,
grow?
It's changing. Portland, like everywhere, is becoming more expensive. I have to say, I don't want to complain, but we really, you know, OSU is the only school we've worked with in Oregon. Now, we haven't really made a big, big push. We would love it if we were doing more work with more colleges here.
I promise I didn't set that up, but this is actually a really nice way to end the hearing and the discussion, because as I mentioned to you before the hearing, we're having, a really productive and good conversation in this legislature about the concept around free community college. And part of that has been making sure that those students who might take advantage of that have an opportunity to get the support they need. So your service could be really important to that effort. So, any last words from the committee? Let's see. Thank you very much for making the trip, all of you. And I'm sure it's not the last time we'll be talking.
Nice to meet you. Yeah.
So we're not going to meet on Friday or Monday. We should be meeting next Wednesday. So keep an eye out for that. Thank you very much. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.